in bewilderment and terror all night, or else taken to my heels with the dog and run out of the house altogether, had I not heard another faint sound. It came from behind me, not directly behind, but from the front of the house. I turned away from the locked door, and went back shakily, groping along the wall to my bedroom, guided by the slant of moonlight that reached out into the darkness of the corridor. The dog was half a pace ahead of me. There was nothing in the room at all. The bed was as I'd left it. There'd been no disturbances. Then I realized that the sounds had been coming not from within the room, but outside it, beyond the window. I pulled it up as far as the sash would allow and looked out. There lay the marshes, silver-grey and empty. There was the water of the estuary, flat as a mirror, and with the full moon lying upturned upon it. Nothing. No one. Except like a wash from far, far away, so that I half wondered if I were remembering and reliving the memory. A cry. A child's cry. But no. The slightest of breezes stirred the surface of the water, wrinkling it and passing dryly through the reed beds and away. Nothing more. I felt something warm against my ankle, and looking down saw that it was Spider, close to me and gently licking my skin. When I stroked her, I realized that she was calm again, her body relaxed, her ears down. I listened. There was no sound in the house at all. After a while, I went back along the passage to the closed door. Spider came quite happily and stood obediently there, perhaps waiting for the door to be opened. I put my head close to the wood. Nothing. Absolute silence. I put my hand on the door handle, hesitated as I felt my heart again begin to race, but drew in several deep breaths and tried the door. It would not open, though the rattling of it echoed in the room beyond, as if there were no carpet on the floor. I tried it once more and pushed against it slightly with my shoulder. It did not give. In the end, I went back to bed. I read two further chapters of the Scott novel, though without fully taking in their meaning, and then switched out my lamp. Spider had settled again on the rug. It was a little after 2 o'clock. It was a long time before I slept. The first thing I noticed on the following morning was a change in the weather. As soon as I awoke, a little before 7, I felt that the air had a dampness in it, and that it was rather colder, and when I looked out of the window, I could hardly see the division between land and water, water and sky. All was a uniform grey, with thick cloud lying low over the marsh, and a drizzle. It was not a day calculated to raise the spirits, and I felt unrefreshed and nervous after the previous night. But Spider trotted down the stairs eagerly and cheerfully enough, and I soon built up the fires again and stoked the boiler, had a bath and breakfast, and began to feel more like my everyday self. I even went back upstairs and along the corridor to the door of the locked room. But there was no strange sound from within, no sound at all. At 9 o'clock I went out, taking the bicycle and pedalling hard, to work up a good head of speed across the causeway and through the country lanes back to Crithin, with Spider bounding behind me and taking off every so often to burrow briefly in a ditch, or start after some creature that flitted away across the fields. I had the landlord's wife refill my hamper with plenty of food, and bought more from the grocers. With both of them and with Jerome, whom I met in a side street, I spoke briefly and jestingly, and I said nothing whatsoever about the business at Ealmarsh House. Daylight, even such a dreary, damp affair as it was, had once again renewed my nerve and resolve and banished the vapours of the night. Moreover, there was a fond letter from Stella, full of gratifying exclamations of regret at my absence and pride in my new responsibility. And it was with this warming my inside pocket that I cycled back towards the marshes and the house, whistling as I went. Although it was not yet lunchtime, I was obliged to put on most of the lamps in the house, for the day lowered and the light was too poor to work by, even directly in front of the window. Looking out, I saw that the cloud and drizzle had thickened, so that I could scarcely see beyond the grass that ran down to the edges of the water, and, as the afternoon began to draw in, they had merged together to form a fog. Then my nerve began to falter a little, and I decided I might pack up and return to the comfort of the town. I went to the front door and stepped out. At once the dampness clung to my face and to my clothes like a fine web. There was a stronger wind now, whipping off the estuary and going through to my bones with its raw coldness. Spider ran off a yard or two and then stopped and looked back at me, uncertain, not anxious to walk far in such dreary weather. I could not see the ruin nor the walls of the old burial ground, away across the field. The low-lying cloud and mist had blotted them out. Neither could I see the causeway path, not only because of that, but because the tide had now covered it over completely. It would be late at night before it was clear again. I could not, after all, retreat to Gryffin Gifford. I whistled the dog, who came at once, and gladly, and returned to Mrs. Drablow's papers. So far I had found only one interesting-looking, slim packet of documents and letters, and I decided that I would give myself the possible diversion of reading them that evening after supper. Until then I cleared several more piles of rubbish, and was cheered by the sight of the several now empty boxes and drawers, depressed by those that still remained full and unsifted. The first packet of letters, bundled together and tied with narrow purple ribbon, were all written in the same hand, between a February of about 60 years before and the summer of the following year. They were sent first from the manor house of a village I remembered from the map as being some 20 miles away from Gryffin Gifford, and later from a lodge in the Scottish countryside beyond Edinburgh. All were addressed to My Dear or Dearest Alice, and signed for the most part J, but occasionally Jennet. They were short letters written in a direct, rather naive manner, and the story they told was a touching one and not particularly unfamiliar. The writer, a young woman, and apparently a relative of Mrs. Drablow, was unmarried and with child. At first she was still living at home with her parents, later she was sent away. Scarcely any mention was made of the child's father except for a couple of references to P. P will not come back here, and I think P was sent abroad. In Scotland a son was born to her, and she wrote of him at once with a desperate, clinging affection. For a few months the letters ceased, but when they began again it was at first in passionate outrage and protest, later in quiet, resigned bitterness. Pressure was being exerted upon her to give up the child for adoption. She refused, saying over and over again that they would never be parted. "He is mine. Why should I not have what is mine? He shall not go to strangers. I shall kill us both before I let him go." Then the tone changed. "What else can I do? I am quite helpless. If you and Em are to have him, I shall mind it less." And again, "I suppose it must be." But at the end of the last letter of all was written in a very small, cramped hand, "Love him. Take care of him as your own. But he is mine, mine. He can never be yours. Oh, forgive me. I think my heart will break. J." In the same packet there was a simple document, drawn up by a lawyer, declaring that Nathaniel Pearson, infant son of Jennet Humphrey, was become by adoption the child of Morgan Thomas Drablow of Eel Marsh House, Crithin Gifford, and of his wife Alice. Attached to this were three other papers. The first was a reference from a Lady M. in Hyde Park Gate for a nursemaid called Rose Judd. I had read and set this aside and was about to open the next, a single folded sheet, when I looked up, suddenly startled into the present by a noise. Spider was at the door, growling the same low growl of the previous night. I looked round at her, and saw that her hackles were up. For a moment I sat, too terrified to move. Then I recalled my decision to seek out the ghosts of Eel Marsh House and confront them, for I was sure, or I had been sure in the hours of daylight, that the harder I ran away from those things, the closer they would come after me and dog my heels, and the greater would be their power to disturb me. And so I laid down the papers, got to my feet, and went quietly to open the door of the small parlour in which I'd been sitting. At once Spider shot out of the room as though after a hare, and made for the staircase, still growling. I heard her scurry along the passage above, and then stop. She had gone to the locked door, and even from below I could hear it again, the odd, faint, rhythmic noise. Bump, bump. Pause. Bump, bump. Pause. Bump, bump. Determined to break in if I possibly could, and to identify the noise and whatever was making it, I went into the kitchen and scullery in search of a strong hammer or chisel or other forcing tool, but not finding anything there, and remembering that there was a wood axe in the outhouse where the fuel was stored, I opened the back door and, taking my torch with me, stepped outside. There was still a mist and a drizzling dampness in the air, though nothing like the dense, swirling fog of the night when I'd crossed the causeway path. But it was pitch dark. There was neither moonlight nor any stars visible, and I stumbled about on my way to the shed in spite of the beam from my torch. It was when I'd located the axe and was making my way back to the house that I heard the noise, and when I heard it so close that I thought it was only a few yards from the house, turned back instead of going on, walked quickly around to the front door, expecting to greet a visitor. As I came onto the gravel, I shone my torch out into the darkness, in the direction of the causeway's path. It was from there that the clip-clop of the pony's hooves and the rumbling and creaking of the trap were coming. But I could see nothing. And then, with an awful cry of realization, I knew. There was no visitor, or at least no real human visitor, no Kickwick. The noise was beginning to come from a different direction now, as the pony and trap left the causeway and struck off across the open marsh. I stood, hideously afraid, straining into the murky, misty distance with my ears to try and detect any difference between this sound and that of a real vehicle. But there was none. If I could have run out there, seen my way, I must surely have been able to reach it, climb up onto it, challenge its driver. As it was, I could do nothing but stand as still and stiff as a post, rigid with fear, and yet inwardly in a turmoil of nervous apprehensions and imaginings and responses. Then I realized that the dog had come down and was beside me on the gravel, her body absolutely still, ears pricked, facing the marsh and the source. The pony trap was going further away now. The noise of its wheels was becoming muffled, and then there was the sound of splashing water and churning mud. The noise of the pony plunging about in terror. It was happening, the whole thing was caught up in the quicksands and sinking. There was a terrible moment when the waters began to close around it and to gurgle. And then above it all, and above the whinnying and struggling of the pony, the child's cry that rose and rose to a scream of terror, and was then slowly choked and drowned. And finally, silence. Then nothing, save the lap and eddy of the water far away. My whole body was trembling, my mouth dry, the palms of my hands sore where I had dug my nails into them as I'd stood, helplessly, hearing that dreadful sequence of sounds repeated again as it would be repeated in my head 1,000 times forever after. That the pony and trap and the crying child were not real, I had no shadow of a doubt. That their final drive across the marshes and their disappearance into the treacherous quicksand had not just taken place 100 yards away from me in the darkness. Of this, I was now certain. But I was equally certain that once, who knew how long ago, but one actual day, this dreadful thing had indeed taken place here on Eel Marsh. A pony and trap with whoever was its driver, together with a child passenger, had been swallowed up and drowned within a few moments. At the very thought of it, let alone at this awful, ghostly repetition of the whole event, I was more distressed than I could bear. I stood shivering, cold from the mist and the night wind and from the sweat that was rapidly cooling on my body. And then, hair bristling and with eyes astart, the dog spider took a couple of steps backwards, half lifted her front paws off the ground and began to howl, a loud, prolonged, agonized and heart-stopping howl. In the end I had to lift her up and carry her inside the house. She would not move in answer to any call. Her body was stiff in my arms, and she was clearly in a state of distress, and when I set her down on the floor of the hall she clung close to my heels. In a curious way, it was her fearfulness that persuaded me that I must retain control of myself, rather as a mother will feel obliged to put a brave face on things in order to calm her frightened child. Spider was only a dog, but nevertheless I felt obliged to soothe and reassure her, and in doing so was able to calm myself and gather some inner strength. But after a few moments of allowing herself to be stroked and petted under my hand, the dog broke away, and alert again and growling made for the stairs. I followed her quickly, switching on every light I could find as I went. As I expected, she had made for the passage with the locked door at the end of it, and already I could hear the noise, that maddeningly familiar bump that tantalized me because I could still not identify it. I was breathing fast as I ran to the corner, and my heart seemed to be leaping about madly within me. But if I'd been afraid at what had happened in this house so far, when I reached the end of the short corridor and saw what I did see now, my fear reached a new height, until for a moment I thought I would die of it, was dying, for I could not conceive of a man's being able to endure such shocks and starts and remain alive, let alone in his right senses. The door of the room from which the noise came, the door which had been securely locked so that I had not been able to break it down, the door to which there could not be a key, that door was now standing open, wide open. Beyond it lay a room in complete darkness, save for the first yard or two immediately at the entrance, where the dim light from the bulb on the landing outside fell onto some shining brown floor covering. Within I could hear both the noise, louder now because the door was open, and the sound of the dog pattering anxiously about and sniffing and snuffling as she went. I do not know how long I stood there in fear and trembling and in dreadful bewilderment. I lost all sense of time and ordinary reality. Through my head went a tumbling confusion of half-thoughts and emotions, visions of spectres and of real fleshy intruders, ideas of murder and violence, and all manner of odd, distorted fears. And all the time the door stood wide open and the rocking continued. Rocking? Yes, I came to because I had realized at last what the noise within the room was, or at least what it reminded me of closely. It was the sound of the wooden runners on my nurse's rocking chair, when she'd sat beside me every night while I went to sleep, as a small child, rocking, rocking. Sometimes, when I was ill and feverish, or had awakened from the throes of some nightmare, she or my mother had come to me, and lifted me out of my bed and sat with me in that same chair, holding me and rocking until I was soothed and sleepy again. The sound I had been hearing was the sound that I remembered from far back, from a time before I could clearly remember anything else. It was the sound that meant comfort and safety, peace and reassurance, the regular rhythmical sound at the end of the day that lulled me asleep and into my dreams, the sound that meant that one of the two people in the world to whom I was closest and whom I most loved was nearby. And so, as I stood there in the dark passageway listening, the sound began to exert the same effect upon me now, and I felt hypnotized by it into a state of drowsiness and rest. My fears and the tensions in my body they had aroused began to slip away. I was breathing slowly and more deeply, and felt a warmth creeping into my limbs. I felt that nothing could come near to harm or affright me, but I had a protector and a guardian close at hand, and indeed perhaps all I had ever learned and believed in the nursery about unseen heavenly spirits surrounding, upholding and preserving us was indeed true. Or perhaps it was only that my memories aroused by the rocking sound were so positive and so powerfully strong that they overcame and quite drove out all that was sinister and alarming, evil and disturbed. Whichever might be the case, I knew that I now had enough courage to go into that room and face whatever might be there. And so, before the conviction faltered and my fears could return, I walked in, as determinedly and boldly and firmly as I could. As I did so, I put my hand up to the light switch on the wall, but when I pressed it, no illumination came, and shining my torch onto the ceiling, I saw that the socket was bare of any light bulb. But the beam from my own lamp was quite strong and bright. It gave me ample light for my purpose, and now, as I went into the room, Spider gave a low whine from one corner, but did not come over to me. Very slowly and cautiously, I looked around the room. It was almost the room I had just been remembering. The room to which the sound I had identified belonged. It was a child's nursery. There was the bed in one corner, the same sort of low, narrow wooden bed that I myself had once slept in. And beside it, and facing the open fireplace at an angle, stood the rocking chair, and that too was the same, or very similar, a low-seated, tall, ladder-backed chair made of dark wood, elm perhaps, and with wide, worn, curved runners. As I watched, stared until I could stare no harder, it rocked gently and with gradually decreasing speed, in the way any such chair will continue to rock for a time after someone has just got out of it. But no one had been there. The room had been empty. Anyone who had just left it must have come out into the corridor and confronted me. I would have had to move aside to let them pass. I shone the torch rapidly all around the wall. There was the chimney breast and fireplace. There was the window closed and bolted, and with two wooden bars across it, such as all nurseries have to guard the children from falling out. There was no other door. Gradually the chair rocked less and less, until the movements were so slight I could scarcely see or hear them. Then they stopped, and there was absolute silence. The nursery was fully furnished and equipped, and in such good order that the occupant of it might only have gone away for a night or two, or even simply taken a walk. There was none of the damp, bare, unlived-in feeling of all the other rooms of Ealmarsh House. Carefully and cautiously and almost holding my breath, I explored it. I looked at the bed, made up and all complete with sheets and pillows, blankets and counterpane. Beside it was a small table, and on the table a tiny wooden horse, and a nightlight with the candle half burnt away, still in place, and with water in the holder. In the chest of drawers and wardrobe there were clothes. Underclothes, day clothes, formal clothes, play clothes, clothes for a small boy of 6 or 7 years old. Beautiful, well-made clothes, in the style of those which my own parents wore as children in those formal photographs we still have about the house, the styles of 60 years or more ago. And then there were the child's toys. So many toys, and all of them most neatly and meticulously ordered and cared for. There were rows of lead soldiers, arranged in regiments, and a farm, set out with painted barns and fences, haycocks, and little wooden stalks of corn, and on a big board. There was a model ship, complete with masts and sails of linen, yellowed a little by age, and a whip with a leather thong lying beside a polished spinning-top. There were games of Ludo and Halma, draughts and chess. There were jigsaw puzzles of country scenes and circuses, and the boyhood of Raleigh. And in a small wooden chest there was a monkey made of leather, and a cat and 4 kittens knitted from wool, a furry bear, and a bald doll with a china head and a sailor suit. The child had had pens and brushes too, and bottles of coloured inks, and a book of nursery rhymes, and another of Greek stories, and a Bible and a prayer book, a set of dice and 2 packs of playing cards, a miniature trumpet, and a painted musical box from Switzerland, and a black sambo made of tin with jointed arms and legs. I picked things up, stroked them, even smelt them. They must have been here for 1/2 a century, yet they might have been played with this afternoon and tidied away tonight. I was not afraid now. I was puzzled. I felt strange, unlike myself. I moved as if in a dream. But for the moment at least there was nothing here to frighten or harm me. There was only emptiness, an open door, a neatly made bed, and a curious air of sadness, of something lost, missing, so that I myself felt a desolation, a grief in my own heart. How can I explain? I cannot, but I remember it, as I felt it. The dog was sitting quietly now on the rag rug beside the child's bed, and in the end, because I'd examined everything and could not explain any of it and did not want to be in that sad atmosphere any longer, I went out, after taking a last slow look around, closing the door behind me. It was not late, but I had no more energy left to go on reading Mrs. Drablow's papers. I felt drained, exhausted. All the emotions that had poured into me and out again, leaving me like something thrown up on a calm beach at the end of a storm. I made myself a drink of hot water and brandy, and did my round of the house, banking up the fires and locking the doors before going to bed to read Sir Walter Scott. Just before doing so, I went down the passageway that led to the nursery. The door was still closed as I had left it. I listened, but there was no sound at all from within. I did not disturb the silence or the emptiness again, but went quietly back to my own room at the front of the house. Chapter 10. Whistle, and I'll come to you. During the night the wind rose. As I had lain reading, I'd become aware of the stronger gusts that blew every so often against the casements. But when I awoke abruptly in the early hours, it had increased greatly in force. The house felt like a ship at sea, battered by the gale that came roaring across the open marsh. Windows were rattling everywhere, and there was the sound of moaning down all the chimneys of the house and whistling through every nook and cranny. At first I was alarmed. Then, as I lay still gathering my wits, I reflected on how long Ealmarsh House had stood here, steady as a lighthouse, quite alone and exposed, bearing the brunt of winter after winter of gales and driving rain and sleet and spray. It was unlikely to blow away tonight. And then those memories of childhood began to be stirred again, and I dwelt nostalgically upon all those nights when I had lain in the warm and snug safety of my bed, in the nursery at the top of our family house in Sussex, hearing the wind rage round like a lion, howling at the doors and beating upon the windows, but powerless to reach me. I lay back and slipped into that pleasant, trance-like state, somewhere between sleeping and waking, recalling the past and all its emotions and impressions vividly until I felt I was a small boy again. Then from somewhere out of that howling darkness, a cry came to my ears, catapulting me back into the present and banishing all tranquillity. I listened hard. Nothing. The tumult of the wind, like a banshee, and the banging and rattling of the window in its old, ill-fitting frame. Then, yes, again, that cry, the familiar cry of desperation and anguish, a cry for help from a child somewhere out on the marsh. There was no child, I knew that, how could there be? Yet how could I lie here and ignore even the crying of some long-dead ghost? Rest in peace, I thought. But this poor one did not, could not. After a few moments I got up. I would go down into the kitchen and make myself a drink, stir up the fire a little, and sit beside it, trying to shut out that calling voice for which I could do nothing, and no one had been able to do anything for how many years. As I went out onto the landing, Spider the dog following me at once, two things happened together. I had the impression of someone who had just that very second before gone past me, on their way from the top of the stairs to one of the other rooms, and as a tremendous blast of wind hit the house so that it all but seemed to rock at the impact. The lights went out. I had not bothered to pick up my torch from the bedside table, and now I stood in the pitch blackness, unsure for a moment of my bearings. And the person who'd gone by, and who was now in this house with me, I had seen no one, felt nothing. There had been no movement, no brush of a sleeve against mine, no disturbance of the air. I had not even heard a footstep. I had simply the absolutely certain sense of someone just having passed close to me and gone away down the corridor. Down the short, narrow corridor that led to the nursery, whose door had been so firmly locked and then inexplicably opened. For a moment, I actually began to conjecture that there was indeed someone, another human being, living here in this house. A person who hid themselves away in that mysterious nursery, and came out at night to fetch food and drink, and to take the air. Perhaps it was the woman in black. Had Mrs. Drablow harboured some reclusive old sister or retainer? Had she left behind her a mad friend that no one had known about? My brain span all manner of wild, incoherent fantasies as I tried desperately to provide a rational explanation for the presence I'd been so aware of. But then they ceased. There was no living occupant of Eel Marsh House other than myself and Samuel Daly's dog. Whatever was about, whoever I had seen and heard rocking, and who had passed me by just now, whoever had opened the locked door was not real, no. But what was real? At that moment I began to doubt my own reality. The first thing I must have was a light, and I groped my way back across to my bed, reached over it and got my hand to the torch at last, took a step back, stumbled over the dog who was at my heels, and dropped the torch. It went spinning away across the floor and fell somewhere by the window with a crash and the faint sound of breaking glass. I cursed, but managed, by crawling about on my hands and knees, to find it again and to press the switch. No light came on. The torch had broken. For a moment I was as near to weeping tears of despair and fear, frustration and tension, as I had ever been since my childhood. But instead of crying, I drummed my fists upon the floorboards in a burst of violent rage until they throbbed. It was Spider who brought me to my senses by scratching a little at my arm and then by licking the hand I stretched out to her. We sat on the floor together and I hugged her warm body to me, glad of her, thoroughly ashamed of myself. Calmer and relieved while the wind boomed and roared without. And again I heard that child's terrible cry borne on the gusts towards me. I would not sleep again, of that I was sure. But nor did I dare to go down the stairs in that utter darkness, surrounded by the noise of the storm, unnerved by the awareness I had had of the presence of that other one. My torch was broken. I must have a candle, some light, however faint and frail, to keep me company. Well, there was a candle near at hand, I had seen it earlier on the table beside the small bed in the nursery. For a very long time, I could not summon up sufficient courage to grope my way along that short passage to the room which, I realized, was somehow both the focus and the source of all the strange happenings in the house. I was lost to everything but my own fears, incapable of decisive, coherent thought, let alone movement. But gradually, I discovered for myself the truth of the axiom that a man cannot remain indefinitely in a state of active terror. Either the emotion will increase, until, at the prompting of more and more dreadful events and apprehensions, he is so overcome by it that he runs away or goes mad, or he will become by slow degrees less agitated and more in possession of himself. The wind continued to howl across the marshes and batter at the house, but that was, after all, a natural sound, and one that I could recognise and tolerate, for it could not hurt me in any way. And the darkness did not brighten, and would not for some hours, but there is no more in the simple state of darkness itself to make a man afraid than in the sound of a storm wind. Nothing else happened at all. All sense of another one's presence had faded away. The faint cries of the child ceased at last, and from the nursery at the end of the passage came not the faintest sound of the rocking chair or of any other movement. I had prayed as I had crouched on the floorboards with the dog clutched to me, prayed that whatever had disturbed me and was within the house should be banished, or at least that I should gain possession of myself enough to confront and overcome it. Now, as I got to my feet unsteadily, aching and stiff in every limb, so great had been the tension of my body, I did at last feel able to make some move, though I was profoundly relieved that, so far as I could tell, there was for the moment at least nothing worse to face up to than my blind journey down the corridor to the nursery, in search of the candle. That journey I made, very slowly and in mounting trepidation, but successfully, for I found my way to the bedside and took up the candle in its holder, and, grasping it tightly, began to fumble with my hand along the walls and the furniture back towards the door. I have said that there were no other strange and dreadful happenings that night, nothing else to make me afraid, except for the sound of the wind and the completeness of the dark. And in a sense that is true, for the nursery was quite empty, and the rocking chair still and silent. All, so far as I could tell, was as it had been before. I did not know then to what I could possibly attribute the feelings that swept over me from the moment I entered the room. I felt not fear, not horror, but an overwhelming grief and sadness, a sense of loss and bereavement, a distress mingled with utter despair. My parents were both alive. I had one brother, a good many friends, and my fiancée, Stella. I was still a young man. Apart from the inevitable loss of elderly aunts and uncles and grandparents, I had never experienced the death of anyone close to me, never truly mourned and suffered the extremes of grief. Never yet. But the feelings that must accompany the death of someone as close to my heart and bound up with my own being as it was possible to be, I knew then in the nursery of Eel Marsh House. They all but broke me, yet I was confused and puzzled, not knowing any reason at all why I should be in the grip of such desperate anguish and misery. It was as though I had, for the time that I was in the room, become another person, or at least experienced the emotions that belonged to another. It was as alarming and strange an occurrence as any of those more outward, visible and audible that had taken place over these past few days. When I left the room and closed the door behind me and stood in the corridor again, the feelings dropped away from me like a garment that had been put over my shoulders for a short time and then removed again. I was back within my own person, my own emotions. I was myself again. I returned unsteadily to my bedroom, found the matches that I kept in my coat pocket, along with my pipe and tobacco, and lit the candle at last. As I gripped the hoop of the tin holder in my fingers, my hand trembled, so that the yellow flame flickered and swerved about, reflecting here and there crazily upon walls and door, floor and ceiling, mirror and counterpane. But it was a comfort and a relief, nonetheless, and in the end it burned brightly and well, as I became less agitated. I saw the face of my watch. It was barely 3 o'clock, and I hoped that the candle would burn until dawn, which, on a stormy day at this fag end of the year, would come late. I sat up in bed, wrapped in my coat, and read Sir Walter Scott as best as I could by the meagre flame. Whether it went out before the first thin grey light sneaked into the room, I do not know, for in the end, and without meaning to do so, I fell asleep. When I awoke, it was into a watery, washed-out dawn. I was uncomfortable and stale. The candle had burned to the last drop of wax and guttered out, leaving only a black stain at its base, and my book was fallen onto the floor. Once again it was a noise that had awakened me. Spider was scratching and whining at the door, and I realized that it was some hours before the poor creature had been let out. I got up and dressed briskly, went downstairs and opened the front door. The sky was swollen and streaked with rain clouds. Everything looked drab and without colour, and the estuary was running high. But the wind had died down, the air was lighter and very cold. At first the dog trotted across the gravel towards the scrubby grass, anxious to relieve herself, while I stood yawning, trying to get some life and warmth into my body by beating my arms and stamping my feet. I decided that I would put on a coat and boots and go for a brisk walk across the field to clear my head, and was turning to go back into the house when, from far out on the marshes, I heard unmistakably clean and clear the sound of someone whistling, as one whistles to summon a dog. Spider stopped dead in her tracks for a split second, and then, before I could restrain her, before I had fully gathered my wits, she set off, as though after a hare, running low and fast away from the house, away from the safety of the grass and out across the wet marshes. For a few moments I stood amazed and bewildered and could not move, only stare as Spider's small form receded into that great open expanse. I could see no one out there, but the whistle had been real, not a trick of the wind. Yet I would have sworn it had not come from any human lips. Then, even as I looked, I saw the dog falter and slow down and finally stop, and I realized in horror that she was floundering in mud, fighting to maintain her balance from the pool beneath her feet. I ran as I've never run before, heedless of my own safety, desperate to go to the aid of the brave, bright little creature who'd given me such consolation and cheer in that desolate spot. At first the path was firm, though muddy, beneath my feet, and I could make good speed. The wind coming across the estuary was bitingly cold on my face, and I felt my eyes begin to smart and water, so that I had to wipe them in order to see my way clearly. Spider was yelping loudly now, afraid but still visible, and I called to her, trying to reassure her. Then I too began to feel the stickiness and the unsteadiness of the ground as it became boggier. Once I plunged my leg down, and it stuck fast in a watery hole until I managed to exert all my strength and get free. All around me the water was swollen and murky. The tide of the estuary was now high, running across the marshes themselves, and I was obliged to wade rather than walk. But at last, out of breath and straining with every movement, I got almost within reach of the dog. She could scarcely hold up now. Her legs and half her body had disappeared beneath the whirling, sucking bog, and her pointed head was held up in the air as she struggled and yelped all the while. I tried two or three times to stride across to her, but each time I had to pull free abruptly for fear of going under myself. I wished that I'd got a stick to throw across at her, as some sort of grappling hook with which to grab hold of her collar. I felt a second of pure despair, alone in the middle of the wide marsh under the fast-moving, stormy sky, with only water all around me and that dreadful house the only solid thing for miles around. But, aware that if I gave into panic I should most certainly be lost, I thought furiously, and then, very cautiously, lay down full length on the marsh mud, keeping my lower body pressed as hard as I could onto the small island of solid ground, and reaching and stretching my trunk and my arms forward, inch by inch, gasping for breath, until, just as the last of her body sank, I lunged out and grabbed the dog about the neck and hauled and strained and tugged with all the force I could, a strength I would never have dreamed I could have summoned up, born of terror and desperation. After an agonizing time, when we both fought for our lives against the treacherous quicksand that tried to pull us both down into itself, and I felt my grip on the slippery wet fur and wet flesh of the dog almost give, at last I knew that I would hold and win. I strained as hard as ever I could to drag my body backwards onto firmer ground. As I did so, the dog's body suddenly gave, and the tug of war was over. So I fell back, holding her tight, and the two of us soaked with water and mud, my chest burning and my lungs almost bursting, my arms feeling as if they had been dragged from their sockets, as indeed they almost had. We rested, panting, exhausted, and I wondered if I would ever be able to get up. I felt suddenly so faint and weak and lost in the middle of the marsh. The poor dog was making choking noises now, and rubbing her head against me over and over, no doubt both terrified and also in great pain, for I had nearly asphyxiated her as I'd clutched so hard around her neck. But she was alive, and so was I. And gradually a little warmth from each of our bodies and the paws revived us, and, cradling Spider like a child in my arms, I began to stumble back across the marshes towards the house. As I did so, and within a few yards of it, I glanced up. At one of the upper windows, the only one with bars across it, the window of the nursery, I caught a glimpse of someone standing. A woman. That woman. She was looking directly towards me. Spider was whimpering in my arms and making occasional little retching coughs. We were both trembling violently. How I reached the grass in front of the house I shall never know, but as I did so, I heard a sound. It was coming from the far end of the causeway path, which was just beginning to be visible as the tide began to recede. It was the sound of a pony trap. Chapter 11. A Packet of Letters. There was a bright light, and I was staring into it. Or rather, I felt that it was boring into me, boring through my eyes right into my brain, and I struggled to turn my head away, and my head seemed to be very light, scarcely set on my shoulders at all, but spinning, floating like blown thistledown. Then abruptly the light was removed, and when I opened my eyes the normal world and ordinary things in it came into focus again. I found myself lying propped up on the couch in the morning room, with the large, red, concerned face of Mr. Samuel Daly looming over me. In his hand he held a pocket torch, with which I realized he must have been peering into my eyes, in a crude attempt to arouse me. I sat up, but at once the walls began to shift and buckle forward, and I was obliged to lie back again, weakly. And then, in a rush, everything came back to me with great force. The chase after the dog across the wet marshes, and the struggle to free her. The sight of the woman in black at the nursery window, and then those sounds which had caused my fears to mount to such a height that I had lost control of myself and my senses, and fallen unconscious. But the trap, the pony and trap!
At the front door.
I stared.
Oh, I still like to make use of it now and again. It's a pleasant way to travel, when there's nothing to hurry over, and it's a sight safer than a motor car across that causeway.
Ah! I felt a surge of relief as I realized the plain facts of the matter, that the noise I had heard had been that of a real pony and cart.
What did you think?
He was looking at me keenly.
A pony and cart? Yes.
I'd heard others. Another.
Get quick, perhaps,
he said evenly.
No, no.
I sat up more cautiously and the room stayed firm.
You take care now.
I'm better. I'm all right. I wiped my brow. I should like a drink.
At your elbow.
I turned and saw a jug of water and a glass, and I drank thirstily, beginning to feel more and more refreshed and my nerves to be steadier as I did so. Realizing it, Mr. Daly moved away from my side to a chair opposite and sat himself down.
I had you on my mind, he said at last. I wasn't happy. It began to unsettle me.
Isn't it quite early in the morning? I've become confused.
Early enough. I kept waking. As I said, I had you on my mind.
How strange.
Was it? Not as it seems to me. Not strange at all.
No.
A good job I came when I did.
Yes, indeed. I'm very grateful. You must have, carried me in here? I remember nothing about it.
I've dragged heavier than you with one arm around my neck. There's not much flesh on your bones.
I'm extremely glad to see you, Mr. Daly.
You've good reason.
I have.
People have drowned on that marsh before now.
Yes, I know that now. I felt that I was being pulled under, and the dog with me. I started up. Spider!
She's here. She'll do.
I looked to where he nodded, to the dog down on the rug between us. At the sound of her name she bumped her tail, but otherwise she lay, the mud drying on her coat in clots and streaks, and pasted thickly to her leg, looking as limp and exhausted as I myself felt.
"Now, when you've come to a bit more, you'd better get whatever you need and we'll be off."
"Off?"
"Aye. I came to see how you were faring in this godforsaken place. I have seen. You'd better come back home with me and recover yourself."
I did not answer for a few moments, but lay back and went over in my mind the sequence of events of the previous night and of this morning, and indeed further back than that from my first visit here. I knew that there'd been hauntings by the woman in black, and perhaps by some other occupant of this house. I knew that the sounds I heard out on the marsh were ghostly sounds. But although these had been terrifying and inexplicable, I thought that if I had to, I could go over them again, if only because I had been growing more and more determined to find out what restless soul it was who wanted to cause these disturbances. And why? Why? If I could uncover the truth, perhaps I might in some way put an end to it all for ever. But what I couldn't endure more was the atmosphere surrounding the events, the sense of oppressive hatred and malevolence, of someone's evil and also of terrible grief and distress. These which seemed to invade my own soul and take charge of me, these were what I could no longer bear. I told Mr. Daly that I would be glad and grateful to go back with him, and to rest at his house, if only for a short while. But I was worried, not wanting to leave the mystery unexplained, and knowing too that at the same time someone would have to finish, at some point, the necessary work of sorting out and packing up Mrs. Drabble's papers. This I mentioned now.
"And what have you found here, Mr. Kipps? A map to buried treasure?"
"No. A great quantity of rubbish, old waste paper, and precious little of interest, let alone of value. Frankly, I doubt whether there will be anything. But the job will have to be done at some time or other. We are obliged to it." I got up and began to walk about the room, trying my limbs, and finding them more or less steady. For now, I don't mind confessing that I shall be pretty glad to let up and leave the lot of it behind. There were just one or two papers I should like to go over again, for my own curiosity. There's a packet of old letters, with a few documents attached. I was reading them late last night. I shall bring those with me. Then, while Mr. Daly began to go round the downstairs rooms, drawing the blinds, checking that all the fires were extinguished, I went first to the room in which I'd been working to gather together the bundle of letters, and then upstairs for my few belongings. I was no longer at all afraid, because I was leaving Eel Marsh House, at least for the time being, and because of the large and reassuring presence of Mr. Samuel Daly. Whether I would ever return here, I did not know, but certainly if I did so, it would not be alone. I felt altogether calm, therefore, as I reached the top of the staircase and turned towards the small bedroom I'd been using, the events of the previous night seeming far in the past, and with no more power to harm me than a particularly bad nightmare. I packed up my bag quickly, closed the window, and drew down the blind. On the floor lay the remnants of the shattered torch, and I swept them together into a corner with the edge of my foot. All was quiet now. The wind had been dropping since dawn, though if I closed my eyes I could hear again its moaning and crying, and all the banging and rattling it had given rise to in the old house. But although that had contributed to my nervousness, I could perfectly well sort out those incidental events, the storm, the bumps and creaks, the darkness, from the ghostly happenings and the atmosphere surrounding them. The weather might change, the wind drop, the sun shine, Eel Marsh House might stand quiet and still. It would be no less dreadful. Whoever haunted it, and whatever terrible emotion still possessed them, would continue to disturb and distress anyone who came near here, that I knew. I finished picking up my belongings and left the room. As I reached the landing, I could not prevent myself from glancing quickly and half-fearfully along the passage that led to the nursery. The door was ajar. I stood, feeling the anxiety that lay only just below the surface begin to rise up within me, making my heart beat fast. Below I heard Mr. Daly's footsteps and the pitter-patter of the dog as it followed him about, and, reassured by their presence, I summoned up my courage and made my way cautiously towards that half-open door. When I reached it, I hesitated. She had been there. I had seen her. Whoever she was, This was the focus of her search, or her attention, or her grief, I could not tell which. This was the very heart of the haunting. There was no sound now. The rocking chair was still. Very slowly I pushed open the door wider and wider, inch by inch, and took a few steps forward until I could see all the way into the room. It was in a state of disarray as might have been caused by a gang of robbers, bent on mad, senseless destruction. Whereas the bed had been made up neatly, now the clothes were pulled off anyhow and bundled up or trailing onto the floor. The wardrobe door and drawers of the small chest were pulled open, and all the clothes they contained half dragged out and left hanging like entrails from a wounded body. The lead soldiers had been knocked down like a set of ninepins, and the wooden animals from the ark strewn about the shelf. Books lay open, their jackets torn. Puzzles and games were all jumbled up in a heap together in the centre of the floor. Soft toys were split and unclothed. The tin Sambo was smashed as by a hammer blow. The bedside table and the small cupboard were overturned, and the rocking chair had been pushed into the centre, to preside tall-backed and erect, like a great brooding bird, over the wreck. I crossed the room to the window, for perhaps the vandals had gained an entry here. It was tight bolted and rusted over, and the wooden bars were fast and firm. No one had entered here. As I climbed unsteadily up into Mr. Daly's pony trap, which waited in the drive, I stumbled, and he was obliged to grip my arm and support me, until I could regain my strength. And I saw that he peered intensely into my face, and recognized by its pallor that I had suffered a new shock. But he said nothing about it, only wrapped a heavy rug about my legs, set Spider on my knees for the greater warmth and comfort of us both, and then clicked at the pony to turn about. We left the gravel and went across the rough grass, reached the Nine Lives Causeway, and began to traverse it. The tide was dropping back steadily, the sky was a uniform pearly grey, the air moist and cold, but still after the storm. The marshes lay dull, misty and drear all about us, and ahead the flat countryside was dripping and gloomy, without colour, without leaf, without undulation. The pony went steadily and quietly, and Mr. Daly hummed in a low, tuneless sort of way. I sat as one in a trance, numb, unaware of very much except the movement of the pony trap and the dankness of the air. But as we reached the lanes and left the marsh and the estuary behind, I did glance back once over my shoulder. Ealmarsh House stood, iron-grey and grim, looming up like a crag, its windows blank and shuttered. There was no sign of any shape or shadow, no living or dead soul. I thought that no one watched us go. Then the pony's hooves began to clip-clop, briskly on the tarmac of the narrow lane between the ditches and straggling blackthorn hedges. I turned my eyes away from that dreadful place for what I fervently prayed was the last time. From the moment I'd climbed into the pony trap, Mr. Samuel Daly had treated me as gently and with as much care and concern as an invalid, and his efforts to make me feel rested and at ease were redoubled upon arrival at his house. A room had been prepared, a large, quiet room with a small balcony overlooking the garden and the open fields beyond. A servant was dispatched at once to the Gifford Arms for the rest of my belongings, and, after being given a light breakfast, I was left alone to sleep through the morning. Spider was bathed and groomed, and then brought to me, since you got used to her, and she lay contentedly beside my chair, apparently none the worse for her unpleasant experience early that morning. I rested, but I could not sleep. My brain was still in a confusion and a fever, my nerves all on edge. I was deeply grateful for the peace and tranquillity, but above all for the knowledge that, although I was quite alone and undisturbed here, nevertheless, in the house below and the outbuildings beyond, there were people, plenty of people, going about their everyday affairs, the reassurance I so badly needed that the normal world still moved through its appointed course. I tried very hard not to let my mind dwell upon what had happened to me. But I wrote a somewhat guarded letter to Mr. Bentley, and a fuller one to Stella, though to neither of them did I tell everything, nor confess the extent of my distress. After this I went outside and took a few turns of the large lawn, but the air was cold and raw, and I soon returned to my room. There was no sign of Samuel Daly. For an hour or so before noon I dozed fitfully in my chair, and, strangely enough, though my body jerked upright once or twice in sudden alarm, after a short time I was able to relax, and so refresh myself more than I would have expected. At 1 o'clock there was a knock upon my door, and a maid inquired as to whether I would like my luncheon to be served here, or if I felt like going down to the dining-room. "Tell Mrs. Daly I will join them directly, thank you." I washed and tidied myself, called to the dog, and walked downstairs. The Dalys were attentiveness and kindness itself, and insistent that I remain with them a day or two longer before I return to London, for I had fully decided to go back. Nothing on earth would have induced me to pass another hour in Eel Marsh House. I had been as bold and determined as a man could be, but I had been defeated, and I was not afraid to admit as much. Nor did I feel any sense of shame. A man may be accused of cowardice for fleeing away from all manner of physical dangers, but when things supernatural, insubstantial, and inexplicable threaten not only his safety and well-being, but his sanity, his innermost soul, then retreat is not a sign of weakness, but the most prudent course. But I was angry nonetheless. Not with myself, but with whatever haunted Eel Marsh House. Angry at the wild and pointless behaviour of that disturbed creature, and angry that it had prevented me, as it would no doubt prevent any other human being, from doing my job. Perhaps I was also angry with those people. Mr. Jerome, Keckwick, the landlord, Samuel Daly, who had been proven right about the place. I was young and arrogant enough to feel dashed. I had learned a hard lesson. That afternoon, left to my own devices again after an excellent luncheon, Mr. Daly was soon gone to visit one of his outlying farms. I took out the packet of Mrs. Drabblow's papers which I had brought with me, for I was still curious about the story I had begun to piece together from my initial reading of the letters, and I thought I would divert myself further by trying to complete it. The difficulty was, of course, that I did not know who the young woman, J for Jennet, who had written the letters, was. Whether she might have been a relative of Mrs. Drabblow, or her husband, or merely a friend. But it seemed most likely that only a blood relation would have given, or rather been forced to give, her illegitimate child for adoption to another woman, in the way the letters and legal documents revealed. I felt sorry for Jay, as I read her short, emotional letters over again. Her passionate love for her child, and her isolation with it, her anger, and the way she at first fought bitterly against, and finally gave despairingly into, the course proposed to her, filled me with sadness and sympathy. A girl from the servant class, living in a closely bound community, might perhaps have fared better 60 or so years before than this daughter of genteel parentage, who'd been so coldly rejected, and whose feelings were so totally left out of the count. Yet servant girls in Victorian England had, I knew, often been driven to murder or abandon their misconceived children. At least Jennet had known that her son was alive, and had been given a good home. And then I opened the other documents that were bound together with the letters. They were 3 death certificates. The first was of the boy, Nathaniel Drabblow, at the age of 6 years. The cause of death was given as drowning. After that, and bearing exactly the same date, was a similar certificate, stating that Rose Judd had also died by drowning. I felt a terrible, cold, sickening sensation that began in the pit of my stomach and seemed to rise up through my chest into my throat, so that I was sure I would either vomit or choke. But I did not. I only got up, and paced in agitation and distress about the room, clutching the 2 sheets of creased paper in my hand. After a while, I forced myself to look at the last document also. That, too, was a death certificate, but dated some 12 years after the other two. It was for Janet Eliza Humphrey, spinster, aged 36 years. The cause of her death was given.